Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in Hour 3, two guests, Karen Malik, will join us from the Abortion Breast Cancer Coalition, and Rita Marker of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. We'll be talking about some items in the news. Some of them you may have heard, some of them you have not heard about. Stay tuned for the third hour. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Karen Malik is a regular guest. She joins us to talk about two issues. First of all, for the first time, a court has actually issued a judgment against an abortion clinic and an abortionist for failing to inform a 15-year-old girl, who is today 19, about the increased risk of breast cancer after her abortion and the psychological harm after her abortion. We'll talk about that and a large donation by a breast cancer organization to the pro-choice group Planned Parenthood. Karen Malik, welcome back to Issues Etc.
I'm so glad to be with you today.
Are you surprised by this first-time judgment against an abortion clinic on the issue of the link between abortion and breast cancer?
Well, I'm not surprised. We had a successfully prosecuted medical malpractice case in Pennsylvania in 2003. And so this case is very, very similar. Both cases involve teenagers who'd never had children before, and they're at much greater risk for that reason for developing breast cancer if they have abortions before first full-term pregnancy. And scientists do not debate that. There is agreement in the scientific community that the woman who aborts her pregnancy has a greater lifetime risk of breast cancer than does the woman who carries a pregnancy to term. So this is one of the two ways that abortion raises breast cancer risk, and that way is not debated. There's universal agreement on it. And it's really the second way that abortion has been linked with increased breast cancer risk where we really find debate taking place. And that has to do with the question of whether or not the woman who has the abortion has a higher lifetime risk of breast cancer than she would have had if she'd never had that pregnancy to begin with. But see, the pregnant woman does not have a choice of not having had that pregnancy. She only has two choices. Either she carries the pregnancy to term or she aborts her pregnancy and ends it right there. So, you know, it's not a realistic choice that the experts are talking about here. And it really addresses the question of whether or not the woman who has the abortion is left with an increase in breast cancer tissue in her breast, more breast tissue that is cancer vulnerable than what she had before she became pregnant.
And I'm not want to call abortion a medical procedure, but any procedure ordinarily done in a clinic, a doctor's office, a hospital, is preceded by lengthy explanations of what could happen, the risks up to and including death, the long-term effects of doing something like this, the short-term effects, what to expect after this, and even if you're taking an over-the-counter drug, there's all sorts of information there available to you if you just want to read the label about what this could mean in term of risks. Why is it that the link that is so clear in terms of its physiology and medicine between abortion and breast cancer is either unknown or unspoken by those who are performing abortions?
Well, there's a money factor involved here, and first of all, I would urge your listeners to follow the money. A lot of money is being made today on abortion and also on breast cancer. There are a lot of cancer walk groups out there that are raising considerable sums of money on breast cancer, and they're simply not telling women about the way that scientists say is the best way to prevent the disease. And what they say is have more children starting at an earlier age, before age 24, and breastfeed your children longer if you want to prevent breast cancer. And in fact, we have a major review of 47 studies conducted in 30 countries that was published in 2002 in the British journal Lancet, and that review said that breast cancer rates in the developed nations like ours could be reduced by more than 50% if women would have more children and breastfeed them longer. And we're just not being told that because these cancer groups don't make money off of preventing cancer. They make money off of cancer treatment.
You can look at it, and I have, and I've done this via a lot of the information that your organization, the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer, provides. You can look at the incidence of abortion and the increased incidence for about 30 years of breast cancer among women. And the correlation there, what alternate explanations do cancer organizations or pro-choice organizations have for the coincidence of these two things?
Well, we're seeing in our nation's breast cancer statistics that it's really the Roe v. Wade generation that has experienced a more than 40% increase in breast cancer rates starting in the mid-1980s. And going right up to 1998, that was a report in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute that the National Cancer Institute and the Centers for Disease Control and the American Cancer Society collaborated on together. And even though their own report shows that it's the youngest of three generations, the Roe generation, which had access to legalized abortion, and not the two older generations that did not have access to legalized abortion. It's the Roe generation that experienced that more than 40% increase in breast cancer rates. And there are no scientists that have offered an explanation for that. And in fact, the authors of this report in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in the year 2001 said that they made no mention whatsoever of abortion. They made no mention at all about how to prevent breast cancer. They didn't discuss any of that, even though two of those authors had done research on the abortion breast cancer link, and their own research showed an increase in risk for women who have abortions. In fact, one of the co-authors, Phyllis Wingo, was with the Centers for Disease Control when she wrote in 1986, along with another government scientist and two other epidemiologists, they wrote a letter to the British journal Lancet, and these government scientists said induced abortion before first-term pregnancy increases breast cancer risk. That was in 1986, and no one told women a thing about it. Nobody at the American Cancer Society or Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation or Why Me, none of them told women a thing about it. So, and I'm offended by that. I'm a colon cancer survivor, and I know that cancer patients go through sheer hell when they're being treated for cancer.
Do you expect more decisions like this? Or, I guess to put it another way, does this decision signal that the facts are catching up or will eventually catch up with cancer organizations and in particular with abortion providers?
Well, yes, it does. And it's interesting that neither of these young women developed breast cancer. As I said, they're young. One of them is 19. The other one was 20 when they won their court cases. One of them won a settlement and the other one won a judgment. So I think that's significant that they did not develop breast cancer, but still they were able to bring successful lawsuits against their doctors for not warning them about this risk increase. It's also significant that this offer of judgment in the case of the Oregon woman was made in the most liberal county in a very liberal state where abortion is considered normative. It is accepted in that county and very well accepted. And I know the plaintiff attorney was stunned by that he did receive an offer of judgment in that locale, in that particular jurisdiction. And I think something else is significant here when we talk about the lawsuits against the abortion providers, because there is evidence, other related evidence, that supports a link between abortion and breast cancer. But this evidence shows that women who have premature births before 32 weeks of pregnancy more than double their risk of breast cancer. And that would make sense because a preterm birth is biologically the same event as having an abortion. Only the mother's intention differs. Now, preterm birth is also linked with abortion. It's one of the risks of abortion. So if a woman has an abortion, her doctor doesn't tell her about the increased risk of having a future premature birth, that child then can go on to develop cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy is linked with preterm birth or premature birth. And I just see a huge medical malpractice potential there for doctors who are not warning about that. We have extensive research going back to 1963 showing a link between abortion and increased risk of premature birth. The state of Texas warns about it. There was an article, a review article, in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons discussing this back in the summer of 2003, an article written by Brent Rooney and Byron Calhoun, who is a Rockford, Illinois physician. And I think this information needs to get out also to women.
We're talking with Karen Malik about this first judgment against an abortion clinic and a physician for failing to inform a 15-year-old girl about the increased risk of breast cancer and the psychological harm that also follows abortion. Karen Malik is president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. Bob is waiting, and he's calling from his car. Bob, thank you for being patient. Welcome to Issues Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Very well.
Anyway, I'd be interested in knowing several things. One, what is the percentage of the increased risk? Secondly, she did mention one journal article. Are there any other journal articles that she can mention or studies that she can identify? And also, I wonder if she can identify the case name in Pennsylvania, I think she said it was. There was a judgment. I wonder if she can identify those.
Okay, thank you very much, Bob. Mm-hmm. Good questions there. First of all, what is the percentage, the exact percentage of increased risk, according to the research?
Well, it depends upon what your certain background is. It depends upon whether or not you've had an abortion before or after a first full-term pregnancy. The more dangerous time to have an abortion is before first full-term pregnancy, and the reason is that women are born with cancer-vulnerable breast tissue called type 1 lobules, and these are also called TDLUs, terminal ductal lobular units. This is where cancers are known to arise. Some of those lobules mature a little bit and develop into type 2 lobules. But what happens when a woman gets pregnant is that the woman, if she's carrying a normal pregnancy, I'm not talking about a first trimester miscarriage, but a normal pregnancy, then she is overexposed to the hormone estrogen, and estrogen's a carcinogen. Estrogen stimulates breast tissue growth, and it stimulates those cancer-vulnerable breast lobules to start multiplying. So if the woman has not had a full-term pregnancy, she's got these cancer-vulnerable lobules exclusively. She has types 1 and 2 lobules, and these multiply. She gets more cancer-vulnerable lobules, more TDLUs, where cancers are known to arise. And this goes on during the first and second trimesters. And during that multiplication process, DNA damage can take place. A DNA mutation can occur. The only process that protects her from that estrogen overexposure is a third trimester process called differentiation. and that process matures the breast tissue into cancer-resistant milk-producing tissue. It starts at 32 weeks of pregnancy, and it shuts off that cell multiplication process so that the woman who has that full-term pregnancy now is left with types 3 and 4 lobules. She has an increase now in cancer-resistant breast tissue. She has more cancer-resistant breast tissue than she had before she became pregnant. And that's why scientists have found that women who have more children have a lower lifetime risk for the disease. And women who start their families at a younger age have a lower lifetime risk for the disease because they get the cancer-resistant breast tissue at a younger age. The woman who has the abortion is left with more cancer-vulnerable breast tissue. She gets more TDLUs, types 1 and 2 lobules. There was a review, going back to your question, I kind of made your question a long answer, but to give you a short answer, there was a review and meta-analysis in 1996 by some Penn State researchers and a researcher from Baruch College by the name of Joel Brind. And they found that women who have abortions in the general population, women who belong to the general population, have abortions before first full-term pregnancy, have an increase in risk of 50%. For women who have abortions after first full-term pregnancy, their risk increase is a little bit lower. It's 30% increased risk. Now, there are high-risk categories also if you're a teenager under the age of 18. You more than double your risk of breast cancer. If you're an African-American woman, your risk increases markedly. Also, if you're 30 and over when you have your abortion, you fall into a high-risk category, and your risk goes up. It doubles. And if you also have a family history of the disease, your risk goes up 80%.
Now, he also asked about articles or studies that you could cite and the case name of the case we're talking about here.
Okay, well, the case names you can get off of our website at abortionbreastcancer.com, abortionbreastcancer.com, and you'll see a link called Legal Issues. You want to click on the Legal Issues page, and that will take you to a table of contents page which identifies the different lawsuits. We've had two here in this country that have been successful. Two in Australia have been successful. And there's actually an Ohio organization, based in Cincinnati, Ohio, called Women's Injury Network. And Women's Injury Network has financed the two American lawsuits. They finance litigation against abortion providers who've injured women. And so if you want more information about that, we offer you a link to Women's Injury Network as well. Now, going to your question about citing the journal articles that have published this evidence that I've been discussing, the journal article that I mentioned in the Journal of American Physicians and Surgeons contains an extensive reference list of the studies going back to 1963 that link abortion with increased risk of a future preterm birth. And so all of the citations are there for the years between 1963 and 2003. And for anybody who would be interested in doing research in that field, I would direct them to that article because that's the article that was instrumental in influencing the Texas State Health Department to warn women about the link between abortion and the risk of a future preterm birth. For information about the studies linking abortion with increased breast cancer risk, I would encourage you to go to our website where we have an extensive list posted on our research page.
And we're talking here about peer-reviewed articles.
Peer-reviewed medical journals, yeah. These are peer-reviewed articles. and the vast majority of them are reporting risk elevations for women who do have abortions.
Karen, before we let you go, one other subject, and we only have about a minute and a half here to deal with, and that is this donation of apparently almost, $500,000
right.
from a breast cancer foundation to Planned Parenthood. What happened here?
That's incredible, isn't it? Well, the Susan G. Komen Foundation gives money to Planned Parenthood, and they are committed to continuing to do this. There was a woman by the name of Eve Sanchez-Silver that abruptly resigned from the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation. She was a Latina advisor. She resigned late last year when she found out that they were giving money to Planned Parenthood. There's a great story about this at the Cybercast News Service website, cnsnews.com. cnsnews.com. I'd encourage you to take a look at it. It's a story that is headlined today. It's featured very prominently on their website where they discuss that. So I would encourage you to look at that. Komen argues that they give that money to Planned Parenthood to perform breast exams, but there are a number of problems with that. First of all, it's highly irregular for a cancer fundraising group to have any kind of relationship at all with a producer of carcinogens, and that's what Planned Parenthood is. There is no debate that abortion raises breast cancer risk in at least one way, one of two ways. And that is it deprives women of the only way to protect themselves against breast cancer by having children. And that's a preventative method of, it's a way of preventing breast cancer.
So just to make it clear, this would be akin to the American Cancer Institute giving money to Philip Morris.
Absolutely.
Something like that.
To do lung cancer screenings. It's the same kind of thing. The Komen Foundation could have used that money to give it to a legitimate health care organization. But by giving it to Planned Parenthood can take that money and use it for abortion. They could push it to the abortion side of their business, and they have been known to do that. They were caught doing that by Colorado State auditors a couple of years ago. In fact, Planned Parenthood's own financial report shows that over the last 5 years, their overall revenue has increased and their abortion sales have increased for 5 consecutive years, but their breast exams have declined 13.6%.
Karen Malik is president of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer. Karen, thank you very much for your time and making us aware of this.
Oh, you're welcome. And please go to abortionbreastcancer.com and visit us.
Abortionbreastcancer.com, all one word, abortionbreastcancer.com. A wealth. I've been there, folks. I can tell you. A wealth of information, the research that you're looking for, it's all there, and you can find it at abortionbreastcancer.com. When we come back, Rita Marker of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, based in Steubenville, Ohio, will be our guest. We usually are talking with Wesley Smith. Rita will be our guest to talk about, first of all, Terry Schindler Schiavo. Stay with us.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Joshua is one of the towering figures of the Old Testament, a successor to the prophet Moses, the first of the judges. He leads God's people into and through the promised land. But as great as Joshua is in the Old Testament, does he serve to prefigure someone even greater? Is there a connection between Joshua in the Old Testament and our Savior Jesus Christ in the New? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Joshua, is a Christ-centered and cross-focused reading of this Old Testament book. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find information there on the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040.
Genesis, just about faith and morals?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Apologetics Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Ken, have you ever heard anyone say, but the Bible is a book about faith and morality? That's the important thing, not its history.
Well, here's how I'd answer them, Mark. The Bible's doctrine of morality can't be separated from its history and its scientific aspects. For example, without the resurrection of Jesus, there'd be no Christianity. It's a historical fact that Jesus left the tomb on the third day and appeared to 500 people at once. But you know, this also deals with science, and scientists who are naturalistic and don't believe in the supernatural declare it's impossible for dead men to rise. Furthermore, the meaning of Jesus' death and resurrection depends entirely on the real history of Genesis 3. That is, a real first man, Adam, really sinned and brought physical death. Therefore, the last Adam, Jesus, really died for our sins and really brought physical resurrection from the dead. You know, Jesus asked Nicodemus, I've spoken to you of earthly things and you don't believe. How will you believe if I speak of heavenly things? The point is, if we can't trust the Bible about earthly things, such as the many areas where it touches on science, why should we trust it about heavenly things, such as the gospel?
Can we also trust the Bible when it says that God created in 6 literal days? It's the topic of a Ken Ham booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com. It's free at AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. A recent survey by the Christian Film and Television Commission showed that in the past year, movies that had themes which stressed positive moral values earned 3 times more money than movies that focused on sex and violence. One Hollywood executive said, I don't know what the lessons are here, except we're making a lot of movies that people don't want to see. Could the lesson be that Americans are fed up with the trash at the local movie theater? Could it be that Christian parents, motivated by the love of Jesus Christ, are forbidding their children to attend some movies? Could it be that through the power of the Holy Spirit, some children are developing a keener sense of Christian discernment? Whatever the reason, this is a good trend. We can help perpetuate it through prayer and family discussions. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Can you break free of the bonds of welfare? According to author Star Parker, you can. On the next Focus on the Family, Dr. James Dobson chats with Star about her years of poverty as she dealt with drug abuse, theft, and abortion. She tells how God helped her find her way out of bondage into freedom and hope. It's a broadcast for mature audiences. Next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Here in the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc., Rita Marker is our guest. Last week, when I was on vacation, Mark Sell sat in, and he had an opportunity to talk with Wesley Smith of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide to get an update on the Terry Schindler Schiavo case. He began by asking what's going on, how's it going with Terry Schindler Schiavo, and Wesley's answer was, not good. Not good. Well, the news hasn't really gotten any better. We're going to get an update initially here with Rita Marker on Terry Schindler Schiavo. Now, we're also going to be hearing from George Philos, who's an attorney for Michael Schiavo, who is the estranged husband of Terry Schindler Schiavo, and he is seeking, as of 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, barring any unforeseen obstacles put in his way, to remove the feeding tube of his wife. We'll talk about that. Also, the Supreme Court's announcement today to hear a challenge to Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, and we'll also be talking about a suicide bill, an assisted suicide bill, in the state of California. Rita Marker, Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
Rita, we've got a cut here. This is we're going to be hearing here from George Philos in just a moment, but first, let's get the rundown on Terry Schindler Schiavo. Where does the case stand? Are we in the last days of this case?
Well, there's always a chance somewhere and somehow, and I understand now that there has been another stay issued, at least until tomorrow, to give Terry's parents a chance to appeal in what I believe is the most promising appeal, and that is on whether or not Michael should be Terry's guardian. Remember that he is acting in his capacity as her guardian, not as her husband. And in fact, he's been her estranged husband for quite some time. He's living with another woman, has two children. But Florida law requires that for a court-appointed guardian, which Michael is, that's where he has his authority to make decisions, that guardian is to file an annual report saying what will be done for the care of the ward, in this case Terry, for the upcoming year. At least through August of last year, he had not filed the required reports for several years. He had just ignored it, and the court had let him ignore it. That meant that he had no authority. And just before the Florida Supreme Court heard the case, that was going forward, and he had refused several times to even respond and give a deposition. Then when Terry's parents switched attorneys, that was kind of dropped, and they tried some other avenues. This, however, I believe, is the most promising avenue, and it is a clear violation of Florida law. Now, we don't know if George Filos and Michael have done some quick and fancy footwork and filed some reports in the interim, but this is a legal avenue that is certainly one that is should be explored.
Okay, here's George Filos. He's the attorney, as you've mentioned, for Michael Schiavo, the guardian, maybe not the guardian of Terry Schindler Schiavo and her estranged husband.
Well, he is the guardian, but he hasn't been doing what a guardian should. Therefore, he would have no authority.
George Filos, here's his version of the history of this case, and I'd like your reaction when he's done.
There was a judgment entered 5 years ago that determined that Terry Schiavo did not want to be force-fed against her will, and the appellate court had said that the guardian is compelled and obligated to carry out that order.
Is this an accurate depiction of the facts?
Well, the court did agree with Michael Schiavo. However, and they said she shouldn't have to do it against her wishes. But it is the court's, and I'm going to say here bluntly, bias that has said that those were her wishes, because, in fact, she had not left any written wishes, and Michael did not remember those wishes until several years after the million-dollar, more than million-dollar settlement was made. At the time when he took this case to a trial to win an award that was supposed to be for Terry's care, and which, by the way, he has never used for Terry's care, he said that he would care for her for the rest of her life and that she had a normal lifespan. And then after that money was in the bank, Michael remembered, supposedly, that she wouldn't have wanted to live like this. So I think not only is it questionable, I would say it is more than questionable, that Michael is trying to impose his views on Terry. In other words, he thinks she should be dead. But it's certainly interesting that he didn't remember that she would want to be dead rather than living in the condition she's in when he was seeking a lot of money.
Here's Michael Schiavo's attorney, George Filos, again, not only reiterating what he considers to be Terry Schindler Schiavo's will, but also using, again, this term force-fed.
She's been force-fed against her will for 5 years. It's about time that her wishes be carried out. You know, she said, no tubes for me. I don't want to be kept alive artificially. And because Mr. Schiavo, as her guardian, is commanded to follow those wishes, that's what he's going to do when it's legally permissible to do so.
Now, there are two things here, Rita, that I find concerning. First of all, the term that he's used twice, and that is force-fed.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that to us. And then the other one is, twice he's already made it sound like Michael doesn't want anything in this case. He's just doing what the court has commanded him to do.
Well, first of all, the force-fed is a an emotionally charged attempt to make this appear as though she's being, you know, tied down and food is being jammed down her throat or something of that sort. In fact, Terry is not being force-fed. She's receiving food and fluids through a tube, a gastrostomy tube that is in her stomach, and that is considered just another way of receiving food. It does not force feed anyone. And the fact that the court has commanded him to do that is ludicrous. He petitioned the court for the authority to order that her food and fluids be removed. The court did not command him to do anything. He's the one that sought the court's permission to be able to do that, and he's the one then that said, well, the reason I'm doing this is because this is what Terry would have wanted. But to say that the court commanded him to stop her force-feeding is just, it's ludicrous.
Finally, George Filos, attorney for Michael Schiavo, says that this is really an issue about Terry's constitutional rights.
Terry Schiavo is not some sort of piece of baggage or suitcase that can be transferred from one person to another. She's an individual with constitutional rights. Her rights have been adjudicated, and those rights are not to be artificially fed against her will.
Your reaction, Rita?
Well, isn't it interesting? He's saying she's being fed against her will, And yet you hear Michael Chivo and George Felos saying, well, Terry's not even there. So that's kind of an interesting thing. They have a little bit of a contradiction in terms there. And to say that she is just, you know, that this is being forced upon her and that she has a constitutional right not to be fed, true, if someone says, I don't want this, then you don't do it. But the person that is saying that it isn't wanted is not Terry, it's Michael. And as far as Terry being property, it is Michael that has kept her almost in storage because he has refused to allow her even to go out into the sunshine. No one can take her out in a wheelchair out into the sunshine. She cannot even look out the window. He has put her in essence as though you would put someone in solitary confinement. He has treated her like property. He has treated her, quite frankly, like a piece of garbage, and it is grotesque what he has done. He has refused to even allow her to have any stimulation of any type, and so it is Michael that is treating Terry like a piece of property. Is Terry's loving parents, Bob and Mary Schindler, and the rest of her family, her sister and her brother, who say, we love our daughter, we love our sister, we want to care for her. That is what they want to do, but he wants to lock her in that room, figuratively speaking, to confine her in that room, actually speaking, and to dehydrate her to death. Now, who's treating someone like a piece of property there?
Finally, here again is George Felos. He is speaking for Michael Chivo. He is Michael Chivo's attorney, and he tells us what Michael's intentions are for tomorrow for Terry.
His intention is to carry out the court order and discontinue artificial life support at 1 o'clock tomorrow, absent any intervening court order.
So what could be the intervening obstacle to Michael Chivo carrying out his intentions for Terry Chivo?
Well, the court has issued a stay until tomorrow so that Terry's parents can file for the rest of the legal action that can be taken. If, in fact, that is filed, and if the court accepts it, then Terry will be safe, at least temporarily, from Michael carrying out his wishes to impose his wish on Terry that she die of dehydration.
Will this request be heard by Judge Greer, who has become notorious in this case for basically rubber stamping whatever Michael Chivo seems to want?
You know, I'm not really sure on that. I don't know which court it is in right now. I'm on the road right now, so I'm not sure. I certainly hope it is not heard by Judge Greer, or if it is heard by Judge Greer, I hope that Judge Greer will at least be open to what really are the facts in this case.
So is it possible that by tomorrow at 1 o'clock, if things do not go well in the court, that Terry Schindler Chivo's feeding tube and hydration would be removed? And if that's the case, would this be the second time? Is this the end?
Well, I'm not sure, again, because I haven't checked my messages. I've been here speaking all day on a bill that has been proposed in California. Mm-hmm. So I'm not certain as to exactly the timetable that goes. If, indeed, they were to begin the dehydration process again, it would be the third time. Three times. Michael has already tried it two times, and he's hell-bent on carrying it out, and this would be the third time. So hopefully he will not have that opportunity.
Rita, you just mentioned that California bill, an assisted suicide bill?
Yes.
Introduced in that state. Tell us about it.
That bill is a carbon copy of the bill that is, or the law that is in effect in Oregon, with one exception. The name is different. When the state of Oregon transformed assisted suicide from a crime into a medical treatment, they did so in a bill called the Death with Dignity Act. In California, the bill, which has the exact wording of the Oregon law, but a different title, that was introduced last Thursday. It is called the Compassionate Choice Act. It would do the same thing if it were to be passed in the California Assembly, and that would be, it would give doctors the power to prescribe a prescribe poison for their patients. And as an attorney who practices in California, and I deal, almost all of my clients are low income, all of my work is pro bono, I can tell you that there are hundreds of thousands of people in California who do not have adequate health care. I can also tell you that law, while it says the patient must request it, there is nothing in that law that prohibits the state from paying for it. Oregon Medicaid pays for assisted suicide there. There's nothing in that law that says a doctor can't suggest it. There's nothing in that law that says an HMO or a managed care firm can't encourage it. So this is just exceptionally, exceptionally dangerous.
Now, there have been kind of, they've been called in the press challenges to the Oregon assisted suicide law. done by former U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft, who went by way of the Federal Control Over Substances, DEA Act, that would kind of stand in the way of this. Some people saw it as a challenge there. I know that it's not technically a challenge to the Oregon law, but would it also apply if Alberto Gonzalez, the president's new U.S. Attorney General, decides to continue Ashcroft's attempts here? Would it also apply to the California law, too?
Yes, it would. And in fact, what that is that the Ashcroft Directive, as it is known, states very clearly that while states license doctors to practice medicine, can you hold for just a minute? This may be a call from the hospital. Just a minute, please.
Folks, we're talking with Rita Marker. She's executive director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, based in Steubenville, Ohio, getting an update on the Terry Schindler-Schiavo case. Also, the Supreme Court announced today to hear a challenge to the Oregon Death with Dignity Act. We're right in the middle of an answer with her on that, and she's told us also about the California law that sounds like a carbon copy of the Oregon Death with Dignity Act, just by a different name. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We'll see if Rita's with us again. Rita?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
My husband has been taken to the hospital in Ohio, and so I'm answering any calls that come in just to see to make sure that I don't miss a call from there.
Whenever you need to answer that phone, you answer it.
Right. Back to...
You were talking about the Death with Dignity Act and the Ashcroft initiative.
What that does, Ashcroft very clearly said he recognizes that states have the authority to license doctors to practice medicine. That is what they do. But it is the federal government who gives doctors the authority, the license, to prescribe federally controlled substances. Now, all federally controlled substances are prescriptions, but all prescriptions are not federally controlled substances. So Ashcroft said, look, you cannot use your federal license to prescribe federally controlled substances for assisted suicide. If you do, you can lose that federal license. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in a 2-1 decision, agreed with the state of Oregon, saying, well, yes, Oregon could do this. Then the federal government appealed and said, wait a minute, this is a state unilaterally trying to exempt itself from the federal guidelines for the use of a federal license. So the U.S. Supreme Court decided today to hear that case in the term beginning in October. If, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court says the Ashcroft Directive is valid, and I believe that they will do so, then Oregon doctors could lose their federal license to prescribe federally controlled substances for assisted suicide. They would still be licensed physicians in Oregon. The Oregon Assisted Suicide Law would still be in place. This is not overturning Oregon's law. And, in fact, doctors could prescribe other things that were not federally controlled substances for assisted suicide. Now, some people might say, well, then what's the point? The point is, well, there are actually two points. One is, if, in fact, the Ashcroft Directive is not upheld, that puts the federal government really in a place of saying, well, you can, you know, we're going to issue federal licenses and you can use those to kill people. That makes it a federal policy that assisted suicide is okay. Secondly, if the Ashcroft Directive were not to be upheld, and if the state of Oregon were to prevail, it would say to every state, you can unilaterally exempt yourself from these federal guidelines to use that federal license. And some other state could say, well, we're going to prescribe federally controlled substances for the purpose of euphoria at raves or at, you know, whatever. So it is a very, very important case.
Now, do you expect Alberto Gonzalez, following in the footsteps of John Ashcroft, to be as diligent in the pursuing of this kind of direction?
Yes, because this is very clearly a case of whether or not states can unilaterally exempt themselves from federal guidelines in an area that the federal government has always controlled. It goes far beyond just the DEA. It goes to any federal regulations where someone has to have a federal license, and so it would impact on just so many different things.
Now, what is your thought regarding the mind of the Supreme Court on this? Do you have any indication from previous decisions they've made pertaining to controlled substances about where they might go with this decision?
Well, some people have looked at the marijuana cases because some states have said that patients can grow their own marijuana or they can give it to each other within the state and this sort of thing. And, of course, marijuana is on the federal listing of controlled substances. But it is different in that case it was not a case of interstate commerce, because the assisted suicide drugs can be mailed. Also, it was in one of the marijuana cases, it was a situation of whether a doctor could recommend it. So it was actually a free speech case. It wasn't a case of prescribing and using a federal license to prescribe that. So I don't think we really know from the other cases. The pro-assisted suicide folks point to the fact that in the challenge of all assisted suicide laws prohibiting assisted suicide back in 97 that they decided, where they said the states, this was up to the laboratory of the states to decide if it should be legal. That also is not very controlling because it would still be legal in Oregon. So this is not overturning the state's ability to legalize assisted suicide. This deals just with the federal license and the federal guidelines for the use of that license.
So when people read, Supreme Court to hear challenge to Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, that is not entirely accurate. This
No.
is really Supreme Court hearing the Ashcroft Directive on controlled substances, which may impact how the Death with Dignity Act actually gets implemented by doctors.
You're absolutely right, because the state has the right to legalize something, but the state does not have the right to say what they're going to use and how they're going to use it if what they're going to use is a federally controlled substance. So you're absolutely right.
Now back to the California law that's been introduced, this bill that you say is, for all intents and purposes, identical to Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. It just goes by a different name. First of all, let's talk about that name. It has a more poetic name than Death with Dignity.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the group that is now known as Compassion and Choices, previously known as the Hemlock Society, and its spin-off organization, Compassion in Dying, in its magazine a few months ago said, our bill is now going to the California Assembly. And so they've changed their name to Compassion in Choices, and now the bill is being called the Compassionate Choice Act. And, you know, there's a saying, and it is so true in cases like this, that all social engineering is preceded by verbal engineering. If you can say nice words, sometimes people will believe it anyway or think it's something else. And if I can I give you just one little example?
Please do.
When my mother came to the United States when she was a little girl, she didn't speak English. She spoke only Croatian. And when she started first grade, she spoke English but not well. Her teacher sent her to the chalkboard and told her to draw light lines, and my mother drew a barrel because light meant barrel in her language. What happened then was that the teacher got angry with her, and my mother was just shattered and remembered it years later. The point being that something that you think means one thing can mean something entirely different. In my mother's case, it caused emotional hurt to her because she didn't understand the language. In this, with this kind of language, calling it a compassionate choice act when you're going to give doctors the power to give prescriptions for poison, that's not just emotionally hurtful, it's deadly.
Rebecca is calling from her car. Rebecca, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes,
Todd? Hi, Rebecca.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've only followed the Terri Schiavo case sporadically, but the question that keeps coming to my mind, why doesn't her husband just divorce her and let her parents take care of it?
That is a great question. I've asked it many times. Rita, what's the answer to that question?
Early on, when he first tried to do this, there was over $700,000 in Terri's trust fund. If Terri had then died as her legal husband, he would have inherited that. Since then, and I believe that the early motivation was the money, that caused such a rift between Michael and Terri's parents, because up until then, Terri's parents thought he cared about their daughter. It caused such a rift that they have fought him tooth and nail since then. He has also dug his heels in. He has spent all of that money, by the way, on legal bills, with the approval and authorization by Judge Greer. So there isn't any money left, but now there is that anger and that I'm going to beat you sort of thing. He is not going to let Bob and Mary Schindler care for their daughter. He won't divorce her because there is such a strong antipathy. And add to that, and I have no way, I can't prove this, I can only say it's a question, and that is, the question would be, does he have book and movie rights planned? Because if he is successful, undoubtedly, that would be down the pike.
Rita Marker is Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, based in Steubenville, Ohio. Their website, internationaltaskforce.org. It's all one word, internationaltaskforce.org. Rita, we keep your husband in our prayers. I hope all is well with him, and thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
One of the ways that the listeners to Issues Etc., we talk about defending life from beginning to end, and this is one of the places where we try to intersect the news of the day, but in far more meaningful way than just simply saying, okay, here's what's happening, here's a news update. Anyone can give you a news update. We're about defending life from beginning to end. Terry Schindler-Shivo is the case where someone's trying to prematurely end her life, or those who want physician-assisted suicide, even against their will, at least rhetorically, defend their lives from beginning to end on Issues Etc. One of the ways that our listeners consistently help us, and they have been so faithful in this in the last year, is our Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's a monthly donor program. It is a structured way of giving to Issues Etc. We have over 100 members now in 2004. In 2005, by Easter, we'd like to have 125 members. Please help us meet that goal for the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by becoming a confessor, a reformer, an apologist at any level. There are benefits like tapes and transcripts and books. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. You will find out there about the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It's also a place where you can join right there online with your gift of either $25 or $100 or $50. Any of those things will get you started in the Reformation Club. Issuesetc.org. You can also join by credit card. Call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. By check, if you prefer to just mail it in. Our address, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. By the way, there's another way to give and to join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. If you have a copy of the Issues Etc. journal sitting around, an old one, the new one's coming out here in a couple of weeks, it'll be mailed to you, look in there. There is a form that you can send back to us and join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. It also has a little more information for you there, right there in the Issues Etc. journal. Help us reach our goal of 125 members by Easter this year in the Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Tomorrow on the program, Muslim converts to Christianity. Dr. Edward Pruitt of Southeastern Baptist Seminary will be our guest. We're also going to be talking with our regular guest, Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, about someone with a silly-sounding name but very serious and sound theology, St. Polycarp. You may have heard the name. You may have thought, who in the world was Polycarp? We'll find out tomorrow with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Also be talking about Muslim converts to Christianity with Dr. Edward Pruitt. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.